I have a distinct memory of what I felt like and hoped for when I considered myself for the first time in a very practical way as a king. After we had moved to Canada from Barbados and encountered winter, that was quite an eye-opener. But as I attended school, there was a game that was played at recess and lunch. Some of you, I'm sure, are familiar with this. After plowing the parking lot, there would be mounds of snow outside, and you know where the children will gravitate to, right? That mound of snow. And there was a game, as you can imagine, called King of the Castle. You knew what you needed to do to be a king of the castle. Usually it was the biggest, toughest students who were able to get to the top. Everyone would try to dethrone them. They would throw them down. If you got there, you got to raise your arms and say, "I'm king of the castle." Oh, I dreamed of that day. I wasn't big enough. I wasn't sly enough. But I'm telling you, one day I got to be king of the castle, and it felt good. It just so happened there had been a flu going around, and all the big people couldn't make it. But that's okay. I could have left that part out, but I didn't. I got to be king of the castle, and that felt good. There weren't as many people challenging me, but I got to be king of the castle for a day. It is, in a sense, a parable or even a paradigm of what we search for too often in our lives. We see our relationships with others as that which we have to compete for. And somehow our estimation of ourselves isn't sufficient if we don't see ourselves or in fact become king of the castle, queen of the castle, reach that pinnacle. We just haven't quite measured up. That notion of lording it over others is so persistent and pervasive in our culture that it makes almost as unrecognizable today what Jesus is saying to Pilate as that which he said then, back 2,000 years ago. What does it mean to be a king and not want to be on top of the snow heap, over above everyone else, lording it over? What does it mean to be powerful, to be in charge, as sometimes used to say in the hood, large and in charge? What does that mean if it doesn't mean lording it over others, having control and domination and being respected for the power and the intimidation that you could wield? What could it mean? Jesus tries to help Pilate understand that. Pilate is accustomed to power. The Rome's military might was unsurpassed in those days. It had the tentacles of power that reached out all over the empire, and woe to those who ever sought to usurp or to be insurrectionist to that power, for the might of Rome would come upon you like a vengeance. Pilate was used to wielding that kind of power. He didn't know what to do with this itinerant rabbi from a backwater place called Nazareth, who stands before him, and others had come and presented him as someone vying for his own throne. This is the king of the Jews. And in those days, the word king, like much of today, had political power and significance. This is the one who is going to undermine you. He was counseling people not to pay taxes. All kinds of charges trumped up against him that had political connotations. So Pilate was worried. He was in a conundrum. He couldn't make sense of this harmless-looking rabbi in front of him and all the things people had been saying. And so he interviews him. But he was frustrated because, like many ways of Jewish culture, you answer questions either with questions or with a story. And he was used to getting the answers he wanted right when he asked them. "So are you king of the Jews?" "Well, you say I am." What kind of answer is that? It's almost as if he's saying, "You want my throne?" Very interesting when Jesus talks to him and trying to discover what it is that he is king over, as it were. How is this kingship, this reign understood? Jesus says to him, "My kingdom, the way in which I reign, is not of this world." Now, too many people have taken that to mean that that which Jesus is speaking of is otherworldly, has nothing to do with the earth, nothing to do with what life is like here. His kingdom comes from some ethereal heavenly place, far removed from the reality of everyday life. And that is not what Jesus intended at all. Jesus is talking about not territory, but origin. Where does that kingdom come from? Where does that reign come from? It comes from the very heart and imagination of God. It does not come from the machinations of people in power who want to dominate. The kind of reign and the kind of kingdom is a kingdom of justice. It's a kingdom of love. It's a kingdom of forgiveness. It's a kingdom of grace. When Jesus is talking about this kingdom, he is talking about a world that God so loves. So it is not about escaping the world. It is about profoundly engaging with the world, but in a completely different way, with a different agenda. Instead of domination, liberation. Instead of oppression, coming alongside an embrace. Instead of vengeance, forgiveness and grace. It is a way of reigning that draws people in rather than separate people from each other. It is the kind of power of love to seep in like water in any crevice that would show itself, to fill it with the fullness of God's desire for wholeness. It is about drawing people into the best of what God intends for them to have, and communities as well. The church is intended to be a place where we come together to learn the ways of this reign, to learn the ways of this kingdom, to resist trying to be king of the hill and king and queen of the castle, to resist powers of domination, because those only separate and subjugate. And much of it comes because of fear. What people do is the two responses usually to life or things that feel threatened. They have fear and they cower almost as paralyzed people. Or they seek ways, nefarious and sneaky and all kinds of ways, to amass more and more power so they can protect themselves. But the truth of the matter is that the more and more power you try to accumulate, there's always someone who's trying to undermine that. You can never have enough power to secure yourselves. It is an illusion. It is elusive. And so Jesus comes to offer a different vision. But he locates that vision in something else. What is interesting is that when he gets to talk about truth, Pilate doesn't have a clue what to do. And Jesus says, everyone... This is the best way of rendering, actually, what the Greek says. Everyone who belongs to the truth, even now, is listening to me. It's a present tense. It's not that they listen to me and it's gone. Everyone who belongs to the truth is even right now listening to me. In other words, notice how the language is used. Everyone who belongs to the truth. So we do not possess the truth. People talk about, I have the truth, or our church has the truth, or our religion has the truth, as if it's some sort of possession. In other words, Jesus is saying we are possessed by the truth. The truth is beyond us. The truth is more than the individual sayings and the words and the things we claim, the doctrines that we claim. It is more than that, for it is in the very heart and substance of God. And Jesus comes to reveal and to invite us into this truth to which we can belong. It possesses us. It claims us. It orients us. It teaches us. It forms us. And what is this truth? This truth is not something to sit and to think about primarily, but it is a person, a reality to embrace. For Jesus says, I am the truth. So Pilate's question was the wrong question. Pilate asked, what is truth? He should have been asking, who is truth? Who is truth? Everyone who belongs to the truth, even now, is listening to me. You know, we're not used to thinking about truth as being embodied in a person, in a reality. You think of the classical ways of defining truth. There's the correspondence theory. Truth is an agreement between a statement of fact and an actual fact. For instance, somebody sells you a device for your car and says, use this in your car, you'll get better mileage. It's easy to measure. If you get better mileage, then it's true or not. That's what's the correspondence theory. But it has its own problems. There's also, in the classical truth test, the coherence theory has to do with if something is true, it's consistent with other judgments that have been made before. So the coherence theory would be if you see someone playing with fire, it says, don't play with fire. If you play with fire, you're going to burn your hands because that has been experienced before. And there's no reason to suspect that it won't be the case now that fire will continue to burn human flesh. That's the coherence theory. The third one is a pragmatic theory. Some beliefs, they work for a while. Truth is true if it works. Well, we know that isn't always the case. The challenge for us when we try to master the truth with our mind, it doesn't mean we don't inquire into it. But what it does is always, this approach seeks for us to be lords over the truth, to feel we have already gotten some truth. What would happen if we believed Jesus' definition of truth and says, I am the truth, and our inquiry is into the way and the personhood and the teaching and that which Jesus models? What if we could understand that this way of reigning and this way of experiencing and expressing truth has to do with understanding the priorities of God, the priorities that belie God's preference for human relationship and community over structures that tell us what to do? What if we understood that it meant learning the ways, the curious ways, and the incredibly surprising and startling ways of love? For this God who is love seeks to have that embodied in the way of Jesus and says, learn of me. That's true. You see, the problem with all of these facts and these classical ways of defining truth is that there's so much of reality that is outside its scope. If you look at a Chagall or Leonardo da Vinci painting, can you say it's true? How do you evaluate if it's true? How do you evaluate if a piece of Mozart or Beethoven is true? How do you evaluate if the love that you experience in your family with your loved one is true? Beauty, relationships, music, love is beyond the scope of a truth that we try to possess. It is rather an invitation to us to participate in discovering the ways of love and beauty and mystery that is God. So when we talk about the reign of Christ, we're talking about the way in which the world would look and our relationships and our regard of ourselves and others would look if we followed the way that Jesus modeled. It would look like, instead of fighting and kicking and punching people off the mound of snow, I didn't do that much of that, really honest. But instead of doing that, it would be looking at what may be seen as monuments or obstacles in our lives. It will look like hands outstretched, generated by hearts turned outwards to make sure that everybody was able to get where they needed to be. Now, you're probably sitting there saying, that's Pollyanna. Get real, Bailey. This is the real world, the dog-eat-dog world. This is where people learn ways of hurting each other and getting ahead, of satisfying their fear. What kind of world have you come from? This is what Jesus is trying to do, to kindle an imagination for an alternate way of living, of loving, of believing, of serving. What would it mean? What would it mean if speaking the truth about the wrongs that we have done, taking responsibility and confessing and asking for forgiveness and the reconciliation that could follow. What would that look like to all of the wounded hearts and lives and relationships that are all around us? What would it look like in our places of political power if we found ways to work together, not because we want to be seen as better than others, but because we genuinely are concerned about the good of a country, the good of a city, the good of a community, the good of the world? What would that look like? Dreamer, you say. Dreamer, Bailey. Jesus stands in front of you and me and asks, do you want to belong to the truth? Do you want to belong to a world where you have a role to play in bringing about the vision and the heart and imagination of God? Do you want to belong to that kind of world? The communities of faith in which we find ourselves are places where God's Spirit makes possible not only that imagination, not only that idea, not only those words, but that reality as we give ourselves to it. Why? Because Jesus says, everyone who belongs to the truth, we belong to it. We give ourselves to it. We give ourselves to this vision, this Jesus, even now is listening to me. Do we have the heart? Do we have the soul? Do we have the will? Do we have the resolve to listen? What would that look like at school? What would it look like at the petty relationships between people vying for significance because of insecurity and fear, because of wounding? They can't be themselves, so they have to fiercely put this front on. What would it look like if those who felt so urgently in need to strive for meaning and strive for importance could relax and know that they are loved, that they are welcomed, that they are belonging to the truth? What would that look like? I want to paint that picture because if, don't usually quote R. Kelly in a sermon, but if I can see it, then I can do it. See it. Imagine that relationship in need of repair. Imagine that insecurity about which you find yourself consumed over and over. Imagine that wound experiencing the salve and the balm of God's grace. Imagine the despair and the depression experiencing the coming together of those who love and care for you. Imagine a world where that is more possible and more the case than the other. Can you see it? Can you see it? That's part of what it means to belong to the truth. Listen for Jesus' encouragement. Listen for the Spirit's strengthening, so that we, this day, can begin to make it present, more present than it is. Each of us, and as a community, go forth in our circles of influence and begin to live as those who belong to the truth, listening for Jesus' promptings. Imagine what our neighborhood, our building, our condo, our school, our place of work, our sports club, our fitness club, our neighborhood, our city could become. Imagine.